Good afternoon. We're here with Professor Devin Curtis, the co-editor of a volume called Peace Building, Power and Politics in Africa, which is a result of seminars between Cambridge University and the Center for Conflict Resolution and involves 17 authors. So, Devin, in the book, you describe different frameworks for peace building, a liberal governance framework, a stabilization framework, and a social justice framework. Could you briefly summarize the distinctions and contrasts among those frameworks?
Essentially, we say that there's a number of different ways of thinking about peace building, and these different frameworks lead to different sets of priorities, really, and different goals for peace building. And so the first one that we discuss is peace building as liberal governance. And essentially, this is really the most common way of thinking about peace building. And really, the assumption underlying peace building as liberal governance is that multi-party electoral democracy and market economies are inherently peaceful. And so that is the end goal of peace building. So the initiatives that are promoted in countries emerging from conflict are initiatives that ultimately are intended to lead to that end goal through building up the state and institutions and so on. The second way of thinking about peace building that we identify is peace building as stabilization. And like liberal governance, stabilization is concerned with order. But instead of order through the state and its institutions and liberal governance, instead order through coercion, military power. And you see that in a lot of the recent peace operations, for instance, even just the language of stabilization is there, building up the coercive apparatus of the state, military, and so on, that this then becomes the priority. And paradoxically, then, militarization becomes part of peace building. So militarization is peace building. And the third sort of framework or way to think about peace building is peace building as social justice. And social justice, of course, there's a number of different questions there. What is social justice? Justice for whom? Who gets to define what justice consists of? But essentially issues then such as inequality, both global inequality as well as inequality within countries, becomes a much higher priority item if you see peace building as social justice.
Given those contrasts and looking at the writers in the volume, you make the point in your introduction that these writers reflect an interaction between local and global ideas and practices, and then you say, which showcase the tensions that occur within and between the multitude of actors involved in the peace-building industry as well as their intended beneficiaries. Could you say some more about the tensions? I understand that there are different frameworks here, but what are the tensions among those frameworks?
So the different frameworks, they're both normative ideas about peace building. I mean, what peace building should look like, what should be prioritized, what should be emphasized. So normative ideas, but also they're descriptive, different people believing that peace building is liberal governance. So you might be for or against it or think that this is a problem, but would still see peace building generally as a form of liberal governance. In terms of the tensions that various authors bring out, and this comes out very clearly in the section of the book that is looking at different case studies, in a country emerging from conflict, there's many different end goals. Different people have different ideas of what peace should or could look like. And it means that sometimes international actors that are promoting particular forms or ideas or institutions may be doing so for certain sets of reasons, and former belligerents or others on the ground might have very different end goals. And so you see this, for instance, in the chapter by David Keane about peace negotiations, that for international or African regional mediators, for instance, they have particular sets of goals that they want people to sign on to a piece of paper that will then lead to cessation of violence. Whereas the belligerents to the conflict might sign on, but might do so for very different reasons, might sign on for legitimacy reasons, but might continue to fight or might factionalize, or they might have different end goals, different objectives.
In the introduction, you also make the rather problematic, certainly very interesting point that peace building may not necessarily always be a force for good. Could you explain what you mean by that and give one or two examples where one of your authors, perhaps, looks on a peace-building experience as not having been or not being a force for good?
The idea that peace-building isn't necessarily a force for good is really related to this idea that there are always beneficiaries and losers from any kind of initiative, program, or change in society. And so it very much depends upon where one stands as to whether they see peace building as a good thing or a bad thing. In terms of examples, I suppose the chapter on Somalia by Christopher Clapham talks about really some of the failures of international efforts to build peace in Somalia through state building in Somalia. If the lack of a functioning state is seen as part of the problem, there's this idea that, well, building up the state is very important in terms of building peace. But he traces some of the problems with that and says that, in fact, international involvement in Somalia has had counterproductive effects and actually has, in some cases, been responsible for further violence because of different factions that have then resorted to violence. And essentially, several of the authors then talk about various international initiatives as potentially closing off some alternatives for peace. It's always very difficult to build up a counterfactual or to know what would have happened had there not been international intervention or had international intervention looked somewhat different. But essentially, that's the argument that if one thinks about peace building as liberal governance or as stabilization, that closes off other avenues or other ways of thinking about how to build a peaceful society.
A certain amount of the work at IPI has focused on the relationship between the United Nations and the African Union in the peace and security field. But at the same time, peace building has to happen within a particular country, not just at meetings of the General Assembly, the Security Council, or the Peace and Security Council. So how important, in your judgment, is the strengthening the relationship between these international and regional institutions for peace building as against actual activities inside a particular country, whether it be the Congo, DRC, or Somalia, or Mali, etc.?
There's a very good chapter in the book by Gilbert Kadiagala looking at the AU and NIPAD, and also the relationship between the AU and the UN and other international donors. But I suppose the question really is, does the AU and the sub-regional organizations, do they have a different vision of peace than international visions of peace? And for the most part, at least in the formal documents, I would argue not necessarily, that in fact the AU frameworks also present a very sort of liberal view of peace building. And that then becomes problematic if we think of peace building in terms of social justice and also which people within a country. So when we talk about African alternatives or African agency, who really are we talking about? Are we talking about the AU? Are we talking about national governments? Are we talking about community groups? And who gets to sit at that table? Who gets to decide on those priorities? And I think there really is a tension, and this is brought out in the chapter on state building by Dominic Zaum, between local ownership and state building and this desire by internationals to have sort of a light footprint, and then the need for a very heavy footprint if you're actually trying to really transform society. And I think that's really a tension that's very difficult to overcome and very difficult to know what to do about.
Following what you have just said, can you suggest one or two examples where community groups have positively and constructively been involved in positive peace building?
Again, I find it difficult to decide what does it mean to be sort of positive peace building versus negative peace building, because there's always a downside really to any kind of initiative. But I think that some of the recent attempts to bring in local groups, for instance, in the DRC, in Congo, to start looking at disputes over land as a matter for peace building. I mean, this is something that I think we're going to hear more about, but that is really important in terms of listening to other types of voices that aren't usually at the table, especially over issues of land. But it really is a very difficult challenge because I think this distinction between positive and negative often becomes quite muddied as soon as we get into the details.
Finally, here we are opposite the United Nations Secretariat. So let me ask you, Devin, what recommendations would you have for the people working at the United Nations to contribute to or strengthen their approach to have more successful outcomes to peace building?
That's the million-dollar question. I suppose it really is about building up processes, better kinds of processes, more inclusive dialogues with different societal groups that tend to be marginalized. That's different from arguments about local ownership. And processes such as the Gacaca process in Rwanda is sometimes presented as this locally grown initiative for justice and reconciliation. But there, too, it's bound up with relations of power in Rwanda and authoritarian structures of governance, for instance. So I think that in terms of recommendations, how to think about including those voices that tend to be marginalized. So not necessarily the voices of national elites only in the countries that are emerging from conflict, but also groups within those countries with different sets of interests, ideas, different visions of peace, and how to get their voices to be heard.
Well, this is a very challenging volume, and we've had a brief, but I think a very thoughtful discussion just now. So let me again congratulate you and the co-editor, Mr. Zinessa, and all the authors who have contributed to this volume. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very glad to be here. Thanks.